From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Happy Labor Day, everyone. Robin and Jeremy are off. International condemnation of North Korea continues following that country's latest and most powerful nuclear test. And the Trump administration is ramping up pressure on the country, on the pressure it's applying on countries such as China and South Korea, countries that the president and others are saying are not doing enough to stop North Korea's nuclear program. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, spoke at today's emergency session of the U.N. Security Council.
The United States will look at every country that does business with North Korea as a country that is giving aid to their reckless and dangerous nuclear intentions.
And today's meeting comes a week after the Security Council met in another emergency session following Kim Jong-un's launching of an intercontinental missile that flew over Japan. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst. He's also with the Security Studies Program at MIT, and he's in the studio with us. Hi there, Jim.
Happy Labor Day, Meghna. Labor Day to those who must work on Labor Day.
Well, I'm falling all over my words here in just getting to your introduction, Jim, in part because it's a little difficult to believe we're at the point we are at with North Korea. I mean, tell us about this latest nuclear test. What do we know about specifically what happened?
Well, I think most analysts were expecting a nuclear test at some point. We talked about – I think you and I talked about this back in April and May when there were major events in North Korea, Kim Il-sung's birthday, for example. And so the fact that they didn't test for a while made some of us think, well, maybe there's some restraint. Maybe they're signaling restraint. But I think we expected, they tested a nuclear device last September. It's September. They've been testing missiles on and on. So I guess we were surprised by the timing, not the test itself. The test itself was significant insofar as it's clear that the North Koreans have made progress in their nuclear program. The yield from this test was far larger than previous yields and certainly puts them gives them an ability, if they build a weapon and put it on a delivery platform, of killing a city. A bomb that big is a city killer.
Right. I mean, we're seeing that it's registered an earthquake larger than 6.0 on the Richter scale. I mean, hydrogen bomb is what they're saying.
Well, there are yields so high that they can only be a hydrogen bomb, but that one is in a range where it could be a hydrogen bomb, it could be a boosted fission weapon, it could be a really big conventional atomic weapon, which is a strange phrase to use. But, it doesn't matter. My colleagues will probably debate the finer points of this, but the bottom line is, if you have a bomb that can kill a city, you have a bomb that kills a city, regardless of what type it is or what its label is. Mm.
So, I mean, is this latest test a game changer, though, in terms of how the U.S. and the international community may respond? I mean, sanctions clearly have not worked.
Well, I would say it's not a game changer, yes and no. This is their sixth nuclear test. It's not their first. It's not their second. It's their sixth. And while it's big, the fundamentals haven't changed. They had a nuclear capability before they tested. They have one the day after. I think it is a political and psychological threshold. I worry about, in some ways, playing into Kim Jong-un's hands that the president would criticize the president of our major ally, right? People say we can't solve this problem without China. Sure, but we cannot solve this problem without our ally, South Korea. And what does North Korea want to see? They want to see divisions between the U.S. and its ally, South Korea. So when the president insults and calls President Moon an appeaser, that is not good.
Okay, so tell me more. Do you think that that's an insurmountable turn or change that the president has done by his actions or his words against South Korea? Or are people sort of taking a deeper measure of the moment and saying, well, you know what? This may be a time where the president of the United States needs to have sort of a line in the sand, for lack of a better term, in terms of how allies can influence the situation on the peninsula.
I don't think there's anything good about this. I don't know of any foreign policy professional who thinks it's a good idea to insult your allies, the allies you need. If a war is fought, it'll be fought in Seoul, not Seattle. We have a joint U.S. command with South Korea, so sort of an unusual arrangement where we are partners, equal partners, and where we have 30,000 troops there who are vulnerable and their families to attack if there's a war. So, and I would say you asked whether it fundamentally changes things. Probably not. Hopefully this is chaff and it all blows over. But let's remember, we have no ambassador. The president has not appointed an ambassador to South Korea. He did not call the South Korean president until today. He called the president of Japan twice over the weekend. He insulted him by calling him an appeaser, and this follows the fury and fire comment, which forced the South Korean president to go on national television to say, hey, there's no war unless South Koreans get a vote on this. I think I worry about the steady drip and accumulation and what that does to the U.S.-South Korean alliance.
Jim, are we closer to war?
Well, Meghna, as I've written, wars don't happen all the time. They don't happen with any frequency, really. You know, they're big events, they're low probability, big consequence events. So on any given day, the chance of war is small. But I think the chances of inadvertent war, war by mistake, war by bluster, I think those have increased. And so while overall the risk is low, it's higher than it was. And the consequences would be unimaginable.
So what do we do? What does the international community do? What does the United States do to, I mean, this now seems like a low but critical bar to avoid inadvertent military conflict?
Well, and I think that's the key here. I don't think North Korea is going to purposely start a war it's going to lose. We get to war by mistake. So, number one, let's improve communications. Hold your friends close and your enemies closer. We should be talking to the North Koreans. We talked to the Soviets when they had 20,000 nuclear weapons pointed at American cities. Why? Because it was in our national self-interest to do so, to make sure that we had clear lines of communication and people didn't mess up. Related to that, how about we get an ambassador? How about we get a U.S. representative in South Korea who can represent the president during these incredibly tense and difficult times? And on China, I think the president threw China a bone on this. He said that they were trying to help. But I think threatening to cut off trade with everyone, you know, that's not going anywhere. So the more you say things that really aren't true, the more you have bluff and bluster, that can lead to the confusion that leads to bad outcomes. So I'd say let's be a little more temperate and prudent. Let's reach out and communicate better with our allies. And let's try to talk to this adversary so they don't do anything stupid.
Jim Walsh is Here and Now's security analyst. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, thank you as always.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's check in on what's happening in Houston, because just outside of Houston, neighbors of the Arkema chemical plant are being allowed to come home. Authorities ended their evacuation orders after waters from Harvey resulted in a chemical fire and a small explosion at the plant. Meanwhile, some residents elsewhere in Southeast Texas are also beginning to make their way home. Houston's mayor says the nation's fourth largest city is now, quote, open for business. But recovery is expected to be long, with floodwaters remaining in many homes and with concerns lingering over significant environmental issues, such as the lack of safe drinking water. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Houston. Hi there, Carrie.
Hi.
Hi. So we understand that you're in the western part of Houston now. What is the scene like? What have you been seeing?
Where I'm at right now, it's just devastating. And the saddest part of this is that most of these people in the neighborhood that I'm in on the West End survived the storm. They did fine. They were fine during the storm. It wasn't until Wednesday, when they had to start releasing the reservoirs out here, that their neighborhood flooded. And it is just devastating. You can't get into this neighborhood, for the streets are rivers. It's just this brown, mucky, fetid, I wish I could describe the smell better, it's just nasty water. But I'm standing in front of one home right now where they were flooded. It was about ankle deep throughout the entire house. You can still see mud inside. And now the waters are receding a little bit, and they're trying to just salvage whatever they can. We've seen people in this neighborhood come up with boats, little rafts. I shouldn't say boat. That makes it sound too ominous. It was just a little raft where they're trying to come in and get as far as they can to their house because they just want to salvage some things.
I see. So people doing their best to save what they can. But I guess, Carrie, that makes me wonder, since folks aren't returning home to stay necessarily, do we know where they're finding shelter?
Well, let me just explain. Where I am right now is a pretty affluent neighborhood, the area that's hit. And so people have just a strong support system. I was talking to the producer here, Art Silverman, spent a lot of time in New Orleans East after Katrina, and just said people didn't have this kind of support system. So people are staying with relatives. They're staying with family members in unaffected areas. We've seen trucks and high clearance trucks go by with boats being carted on the back of them so that they could get in. This woman's walking down the street right now with two inner tubes that she's going to try and wade down to her house. So people have support here. The people that don't have support, that were thrown from their homes, are in the larger shelters. The Red Cross has a huge shelter in the downtown area with thousands of people still in it.
I see. And residents that you've spoken with, you know, how are their spirits? How are they feeling right now?
It depends where you are in the city, and it depends what kind of support system you have and who's come in and helped. I don't know if you could hear right now, there's a high-clearance vehicle just wading through this water right now, coming right by. But the woman that I spoke to right now, she just had tons of friends that have come to help her remove everything from her home. I just watched, she said anything that has material, like all these stuffed animals of her daughter she was taking out, and she had to put them in garbage bags and throw it away because of the fetid water and the mold contamination that everybody is fearing is coming next. There's about 40 to 50 large industrial sized black garbage bags on her front lawn, just that they're hoping will get carted away. But people's spirits are good. She just said one thing's interesting. Tomorrow is the beginning of the work week.
Yeah.
And people need to go back to work. And she said she's really worried about not having support anymore to help her with this enormous task in front of her.
NPR's Carrie Kahn reporting from Houston. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
The U.S. is criticizing China for not putting more pressure on North Korea over its weapons program. But China is also under fire for something else entirely, for censorship. The Cambridge University Press recently removed hundreds of articles from a Chinese website which hosts a leading journal on Chinese affairs. And that's because China's Communist Party threatened to cut online access to all the journals published by the Cambridge Press. John Pomfret was Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post. His latest book is The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. He's with us from KQED in San Francisco. John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, tell us more about this case with Cambridge University Press. What exactly happened?
It seems that it's part of a deal to have more access, allowed more access for Cambridge University's materials in China, which is a money-making venture. The Cambridge University Press basically decided to block access to about 300 articles published in the China Quarterly. And they're about a variety of issues that are considered still in China very sensitive today. So such as the Great Leap Forward famine, the Tiananmen Square crackdown in 1989, the Cultural Revolution, the legacy of Chairman Mao, issues such as that. And these are articles written in English, but they're academic articles. And, you know, by their very nature, they have a relatively limited readership. Nonetheless, the Communist Party is very aggressive at seeking out any opportunity to censor different narratives involving their history than the official narrative approved by Beijing.
And so this aggressiveness, what was the response to that from academic circles, both inside of China and outside of China?
Well, particularly from outside of China, there was an uproar in the academic community where a series of scholars started petitions which basically said, you know, you can't do this. This is just outrageous behavior to basically allow your stuff to be or to willingly self-censor your stuff. If the Chinese block your site, that's one thing. But for you to begin to take specific articles off the site that the Chinese have identified as somehow at variance with their ideology, that really moves into the category of facilitating China's ideological control over what its people can and cannot read. And so given this backlash, and there were petitions signed and a lot of op-eds written, Cambridge University Press buckled to the pressure and put the pieces back online and actually opened access to all of them for readers in China.
Interesting. Now, you know, these events that you talked about that these papers had to do with the Great Leap Forward and the massive famine associated with that, all the way to Tiananmen Square, I mean, these are seminal moments in China's modern history. Why would the Communist Party be so sensitive to these academic papers when it's not as if it just getting rid of those 300 papers would erase the collective memory surrounding these events?
Well, the party has always been very focused on the control of history as a way to justify or to legitimize its rule. And the Chinese view history not as something in the past, but as something that is used by rulers to control the present and the future. And so with that in mind, their desire to oppress, suppress, blot out alternative narratives of what actually went on is extremely high, especially at this moment. They're involved in a very serious political transition with the 19-party Congress, and they're also led by a leader in Xi Jinping who has railed against what he calls historical nihilism, which is basically the tendency of some people in China and, you know, academics overseas as well, to question the wisdom and the wonderful rule of the Communist Party of China.
He calls that historical nihilism?
He calls that historical nihilism. If you write about the famine during the Great Leap Forward, where 30 to 40 million people are believed to have died, that would be historical nihilism. If you write about the Cultural Revolution, when 600,000 plus very highly educated Chinese were probably murdered by the state or by the Red Guard, that would be historical nihilism. If you basically dig up any dark secret of the communist regime's past, that's considered historical nihilism. And they've launched a nationwide campaign to crush this out. And this censorship activity and this pressure on the Cambridge University Press is just part of that campaign.
So these events, since they occurred in China's modern history, the ones that we're talking about, I mean, there are still many people in China who lived through that. I mean, is the government just sort of trying to erase what written aspects of this history and just playing a long waiting game until those people who experienced it are also gone?
Yeah, I mean, their calculus is that, yeah, they cannot suppress the individual memories of people. But what they can do is, by limiting those memories to families and by denying those people the right to publish memoirs on the issue, and by ensuring that it doesn't enter the classroom, they can achieve a certain amount of sort of mass amnesia. That's why, you know, people have started calling China the People's Republic of Amnesia.
Huh. And what is your sense of the reaction from within China? I mean, are shruggingly accepting this, or is there a backlash from within China itself?
Generally speaking, in the academic community, they're aghast at this type of behavior. And the regime of Xi Jinping has really squeezed the intellectual classes in China very hard. In terms of the wiggle room for political debate, it's tighter than it was at any point in China since the 1989 crackdown on pro-democracy protests around Tiananmen Square. If you push back too hard, you could go to jail. You could lose your job. And so the party has enormous number of levers that it can use to squeeze people to ensure that even though they're unhappy in their positions and they really oppose the censorship, they can't do anything to stop it.
Mm. So, John, I have a question on my mind, which I have to think about the right way to ask it, because this question of the control of historical memory is not unique to China.
For sure.
Now, of course, in the United States, there is intense debate over statues, for example, that celebrate members of the Confederate South. Now, I'm not equating the two, because, of course, in the case of the statues in the United States, those are statues that are celebrating, you know, men who went out of their way to subjugate an enslaved population in the United States. And whereas in China, we're talking about papers that are written in order to preserve the memory of the many who suffered and died under various Chinese political revolutions. So I mark the difference. But I guess my question is, are there any echoes here that we here in the United States can learn from what's being done by the Chinese government there?
When I think of the statues, I think about what the Eastern Europeans did with many of their statues from the Soviet era, which in several cases they just stuck them all in one park and turned the park into kind of a museum, if you will, to an ideology that had worn out its welcome in Eastern Europe. And that's in some ways, in one could say, a health. I mean, you could smash the statues like were done in several instances in Eastern Europe or in, for example, Baghdad. Mm-hmm. But you could also kind of, in a weird way, put them away in a park and just say, well, that's the past, and lock, you know, let people wander through them on a Sunday picnic and see what people once thought. In China, it was really interesting because after the Cultural Revolution ended in 1976, there was a whole spate of removals of the large statues of Chairman Mao that used to stand in front of almost any major institute in China. I mean, they make the Robert E. Lee statue look like a pawn on a chessboard. I mean, these things are 80 feet tall, right? There's the chairman, you know, with his hand up in a kind of semi-Heil Hitler salute. And a lot of them were removed after the Cultural Revolution. But then in very, very quickly in the early 80s, that the removal of those statues was stopped because the party bigwigs realized that they couldn't totally negate Mao, because if they did, they would actually be negating themselves. And that's when basically China's censorship, because there was this really interesting window of openness in China from around 77, 78 up until about 81, 82. And then it ended. And then the openness came back again in the late 80s. And then, of course, there was a crackdown on Tiananmen Square, and it ended. And so China's had this spasmodic openness and closed rhythm since then. And I wonder if in the United States we're kind of going through that right now as well. Hmm. Again, as you said, with the recognition that it's not smart to make false equivalencies about our issues and their issues. But nonetheless, there is a sense. And in very interesting ways, America and China's history kind of moves together in this strange pattern. Like they had their Cultural Revolution, we had our 1960s. During the Civil War, we had our Civil War. They had their Taiping Rebellion. And so from that perspective, you know, sort of the cosmic connections, if you will, between us and them, there is a similarity or a verisimilitude between the two places, which is something that I get into a lot in my book.
Yeah. Well, John Pomfret is former Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post, and his latest book is The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. John, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
While Texas and Louisiana are cleaning up after Harvey, forecasters are watching another powerful hurricane that's developing in the Atlantic. Hurricane Irma will strike the Leeward Islands in the Eastern Caribbean by Wednesday, and there's growing concern about its potential impact on the U.S. mainland. Jeff Masters is the Director of Meteorology for Weather Underground. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, it seems as if right now Irma is a Category 3 storm, so already fairly strong. Is there any way that we can know how much stronger it's going to get before it makes landfall?
Our best intensity models say that we can expect this to intensify to a Category 4 or 5 hurricane with winds between 130 and 160 miles per hour over the next 3-4 days. Now, one thing that could stop that from happening is if this storm hits the high mountainous islands of Hispaniola or Cuba. And certainly Cuba is directly in the path of this storm as far as the latest forecast goes.
Okay. And so what about other islands? Antigua, St. Kitts, Nevis. Who else is currently in the path or should fear being in the path of the storm?
The islands of the northeastern Lesser Antilles, the ones you mentioned, are the ones that are going to get the wrath of Irma first. And it'll probably be a Category 3 or 4 hurricane at that point tomorrow. But it's going to pass very close to the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico on Wednesday. And those islands will be on the weaker left side of the hurricane, which means they won't quite get the full brunt of it. But the Bahamas are more at risk in the Turks and Caicos Islands because it looks like Irma is going to plow directly into them. And it's also going to pass very close to the Dominican Republic and Haiti, where flooding is always a huge concern.
And is there any way for us to know whether this will remain an Atlantic hurricane or turn into a Gulf one?
It's looking likely that it's going to make it into the Gulf of Mexico, at least as far as our five-day forecasts go, which do have high airs in excess of 500 miles. But it's probably going to affect Florida by Friday. We're thinking that by Friday night, Florida could start experiencing tropical storm force winds. They're going to have to make a decision tomorrow, probably in the Florida Keys, on whether they would evacuate or not, because the Keys need at least 3 days to evacuate.
Huh. Wow. Okay. So just for clarification here, I mean, I've also been seeing stories that say that some forecasting models put Irma as coming up the eastern seaboard. Is that still also a possibility?
That is a possibility. Certainly the coast of South Carolina and North Carolina are at risk from this storm. But what it could do is come into Cuba and then turn northwards over Florida or on one side of the peninsula or the other. Could be the Gulf side, could be the Atlantic side, and then move northward and make several landfalls along the way.
Okay, so it seems as if the further out we go in our forecast, there's still a great degree of uncertainty.
There's a huge amount of uncertainty, but the models are in very tight agreement over the next 4 or 5 days, which gives us some confidence that certainly the Bahamas and Cuba are at great risk from the storm, and Florida is going to feel significant impacts as well. I would expect at the very least they're going to get 5 to 10 inches of rain from this storm starting Friday.
Okay. Now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has predicted that the 2017 hurricane season would be more active than average. I mean, how is it shaping up so far?
Yeah, it's certainly that. The halfway point of the season is typically September 10th, and we've already had almost a full season's worth of activity. We've had 9 named storms, 4 of them hurricanes, 2 major hurricanes, and that's a lot of activity.
Wow, no kidding. Well, Jeff Masters is Director of Meteorology for Weather Underground. Jeff, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
The Los Angeles Community College District said this summer that 1 in 5 of its students is homeless, and nearly 2/3 can't afford nutritious meals. And this is a problem coast to coast. Some tallies put the number of homeless college students nationwide at 57,000. And a survey in Massachusetts shows nearly half of that state's college campuses saw an increase in homeless students in the past year. Back in February, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd visited one of those schools, and today we're revisiting his story.
Mr. Tom, what's going on, my brother?
How you doing, man?
You're a popular guy.
I am. Yeah.
Lorenz Marsalis is the kind of student who struts through a busy college campus with confidence. But the senior at Bridgewater State University in eastern Massachusetts isn't a typical student. He moved here from Haiti at 14. When he was a high school senior, his father ran out of money to pay the rent. So the lanky, gregarious teenager moved with his family into a motel and eventually into a homeless shelter.
And I remember after school thinking, where am I going to sleep tonight, kind of thing. And it wasn't easy. It was hard on me mentally.
Marsalis excelled at school against the odds. Research shows the stress of homelessness and hunger wreaks havoc on a student's performance. So I asked Marsalis to take me to one of 2 food banks at Bridgewater State. It's where we met campus minister Marlene De Leon.
Here it is. It's not big.
Actually, the food bank is tiny, just a few shelves tucked away in a corner at the Catholic Center.
We got some, looks like some bags of pasta here. And
pasta?
Standard fare for a college campus,
very popular, right? Also popular is this cold cereal up there. Not that I think that's the best nutritious breakfast, but that's what students like. You can see corn. We have lots of canned vegetables.
Got some cut yams, some green beans, some black beans. Right. Tell me about the need.
So on campus, the need has increased. Most students here work. I would say 95% of the students work probably at least 20 hours a week. And that's to pay for all of their expenses of school, but also a car. And they may run out. So they come here and they supplement what they're doing for their own food with the food here.
So the students going here, there's a gap between what they can make and what they get in aid. There's often, you're saying, there's just still not enough.
Correct, correct. And you also have students who may be homeless. They may have been foster children. They're now at an age where they're no longer cared for by a parent or a guardian. Some of the students don't have any housing and have to be here during vacation. They need food during that vacation.
Before I met Lorenz, I didn't often think about college kids and homelessness. You don't often put the two together, but you're saying that it is a real problem.
It's a reality, yes. And it's a hidden reality.
And it's a reality that researchers are trying to learn more about. The problem appears to be growing, along with tuition rates, student debt, and the cost of living in American cities.
There's a lot more need out there.
Michelle Wakin runs the Bridgewater Scholars Program, which gives up to 2 high-achieving students like Lorenz Marsalis a scholarship to cover tuition and living expenses. At some point in their lives, Wakin says every student on the scholarship has been homeless.
Defining what homelessness is really difficult. It's episodic. You never know when it's going to hit your family or for how long it's going to hit or whether it's going to mean, you know, couch surfing.
I met a few of Wakin scholars who know very well what it's like.
My story, I came from my country, Kivert, when I was 15 years old.
Anna Lobo moved to the United States without her parents and was promptly kicked out of her sister's house when Lobo told her she was pregnant.
We lived a few months in a basement.
And then moved to a shelter.
And I stayed there for like 8 years.
And so you raised your baby there?
Yes. We went there when she was 6 months. That's when they started supporting us with the school. It was hard for me because of the language. And I had dropped out of school when I was like 10 years old in kindergarten. And coming back to school was pretty hard. Speaking a different language, it was worse. But I got through it, and I got my diploma.
Wow. So what made you decide that you were going to come to college?
My daughter. After I gave birth to her, I had to take a big decision, which was find a better life for her and for me.
Now 27, Lobo wears a big smile and trendy glasses. She's about to graduate with a degree in social work. Next to her is junior Zachary Wright, a math major. He also lived in a shelter for a few months one summer after his mother fled an abusive relationship.
It's a small place. There's like no air conditioning. There's nothing to do around there.
7 months later, they got out of the shelter on Cape Cod when Wright's mother found them a new place to live.
So things at that time were looking up. I was getting good grades. And then one of the most unexpected things to happen to me happened, which was when I was 16, my mother passed away. And I didn't have a father. And my stepfather wasn't with us. For some time, I was just by myself with my brother. You know, it's really hard when you have had one, like, main pillar of support for most of your life, and then they just disappear. So.
I'm so sorry to hear that story. What happened after your mother died? You said your brother was around. I mean, where were you guys staying at that point?
So my brother was also in high school with me. Mm-hmm. So we were alone in our housing that we had gotten for a little while until my sister, she was offering to, you know, take us in. She was someone I hadn't seen like ever since I was young. So I didn't really have that great relationship with her at that time.
But you knew. So just like everybody else, you knew the way out of this was by going to school, right? I mean, but how did you know that? I mean, how did you have the presence of mind to even know that?
Well, first and foremost, like public education, it's free. So for me, that's like a prime opportunity. You need to just take it because really it's, you know, the foundation to ending poverty in my eyes.
Yeah. Sure, but somebody had to teach you that. I mean, somebody was a good enough influence on you to sort of tell you that at some point, I guess. Or did that something that come from inside of you, do you think?
I think a part of it was in it, but, you know, my mom was always hammering me that into me ever since I was little.
Wright is shy, but smart. His GPA, nearly perfect. And his story hit a nerve around the table. Because the students here know what it's like to have a safety net that's threadbare. For them, the difference between failure and success might be nothing more than a memory of a loved one. That's the way it is for Nayara Semedo, a formerly homeless freshman whose mother lives thousands of miles away on the west coast of Africa.
I feel like it's different when you hear other people's stories because you think you've been through it all. You think you've hit rock bottom until you hear other people's struggles, you know. I always felt like I was different from my friends because they never been through what I have. They always had, They always had their parents, their mom and dad, to help them with everything. And me, it was just me. And now it feels like I belong because I'm not the only one who has been through what I have. There's different people who, you know, have been through worse. And in a way, it feels good because you know you're not by yourself, you know.
You're not, and you're making it, by the way. I mean, you're doing the work. You're getting through it.
Yeah.
There you go. This is my room.
Before I left Bridgewater, I asked Lorenz Marcellus to show me his apartment. It's typical. He's pinned a Haitian flag on the wall next to a poster of Bob Marley. And it's not lost on him that in a few months he'll need a job and that he'll be leaving the safety of this home.
knowing that I'm going to be doing that is kind of scary, and not knowing the next step, so to speak.
Yeah. What kind of perspective do you think you have on life at 23 that most people don't?
For me, it's being humble. It's one thing to hear about homelessness. It's another thing to experience it. I mean, I was humble before, but, you know, that really humbled me more.
Humbled, but determined not to look back. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And we have a few updates since Peter's story ran back in February. Lorenz Marcellus is starting a fellowship at City Year, a job training program that helps bridge the achievement gap for low-income students. Zachary Wright has one more year of school before he graduates, and this summer he spent time with his brother on a military base. They hadn't seen each other in several years. And Anna Lobo has two classes left before graduating. She spent the past few months with her fiancé and daughter. We wish them all continued good luck. Advocates say the job market is pretty bleak for people with disabilities who are looking for work. In July, the labor force participation rate for people with disabilities was just under 21%, compared to 69% for those who are able-bodied. Those numbers are from the U.S. Department of Labor. So why is this? Well, joining us now is Helena Berger, president of the American Association of People with Disabilities. And Helena, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed 27 years ago, and job numbers for those with disabilities have remained pretty stagnant, though. I mean, isn't the ADA supposed to provide accommodations for people with disabilities?
Right. It's, you know, Title I of the ADA is the non-discrimination piece as far as it pertains to hiring people with disabilities, which includes accommodations. But I think one of the main reasons we still see a very high unemployment rate for people with disabilities is the attitudinal barriers. You know, again, ADA is an incredible civil rights law for people with disabilities, but it doesn't legislate attitude. So if you have this conscious or unconscious bias about people with disabilities, if you think, you know, they may be more sick, or if it doesn't work out, I may get sued, or the accommodations may be too expensive. There are also, you know, stigmas attached to certain disabilities. For example, you know, a higher rate of unemployment if you have a psychiatric disability, if you have an intellectual disability. So I think, you know, that's a big barrier.
Mm-hmm. Well, your organization actually puts out what's called the Disability Equality Index every year, a survey by the U.S. Business Leadership Network. Can you tell us about that and what you look for and what the big takeaway was from this latest survey?
Sure. So we initiated it in 2013. We had a pilot project in 2014. Since that time, we've seen about 130% increase in companies taking the index. As a matter of fact, this year we saw a 32% increase compared to last year. And basically what it is, it's a transparent, objective benchmarking tool for primarily Fortune 500, 1,000 companies. We look at culture and governance. We look at employment practices, hiring practices, accessibility, as well as how external facing they are with their customers. So, yes, and it's a gauge to figure out how well they're doing in all of those areas from, again, from hiring to retention to promotion. You know, are there people with disabilities in executive management? Are there people with disabilities on the board? And I think one of the things that makes this tool really unique is that we have an advisory committee, and this advisory committee is comprised of both people from the disability community and business community. So it's a really very fair and very thoughtful and balanced approach to looking at this. Mm.
So I've got to ask you, you mentioned earlier that, yes, the Americans with Disabilities Act was a landmark civil rights legislation. But really one of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you today is because you're also making the argument that hiring people with disabilities isn't just a civil rights issue, but it could actually be a potential economic boon for a business, right? And so why is that? What evidence do you have of that?
Well, I think what we see is certainly that from a business perspective, we see a large baby boom population that's going to be retiring. So there's no doubt that companies are going to have a void. And we also know that there's a very large pool of really talented people with disabilities that are just waiting to get employed. So I think you can fill that void. You can start creating a pipeline of folks. You can do that directly through hiring or, you know, more internships, more fellowships. So clearly from that standpoint, again, a very talented pool of people with disabilities. If you talk to businesses, they also say that people with disabilities are very creative, are very innovative. I think think, you know, a lot of times people with disabilities, because of some of the challenges or barriers they may face on a regular basis, they figure out, hey, how can I overcome that? And they take that creativity and innovation and they bring it to the workplace.
Huh. Well, I am curious, though, because earlier you talked about how one of the biggest barriers right now are the unconscious biases that might keep employers from hiring people with disabilities. I mean, that's a really tough nut to crack, obviously. So, I mean, how would you suggest that businesses do that?
I think, you know, you have to start hiring, you know, interacting and working with people with disabilities, because the only way to break down that barrier is once you start that interaction. I mean, we've seen it happen in other communities. You know, we see it in the LGBT community, how so many of those barriers have been broken down. And I think it's true in the disability community. It starts by hiring that first person, and you realize whatever fear, whatever stigma, with you know, whatever stereotype, you know, it will be erased if you have that interaction, you know. And I think if you start instituting more programs where you start bringing people in maybe through internships, in my opinion, that's the best way to break down that barrier. I also think because companies are making a bigger effort around disability inclusion in the workplace, I think competition will help. You know, if you're, let's just say, in the banking industry and your competitors are hiring people with disabilities and they're telling you, you know, my workforce is better because of it, my business is better because of it, my bottom line is better because of it, you know, I think you're going to listen and those positive stories will go a long way.
Yeah. Well, Helena Berger is president of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Helena, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and GEICO, celebrating over 75 years of providing auto insurance for drivers across America. More information on auto insurance available at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.